No, yesterday in the sauna, well, actually outside of the sauna, I was seeing the old washboards. So there's one that's carved in wood, and then there are the high-tech ones in metal that people used for washing clothes. And on this side here of the building are the plows, hand plows, and they're well used. You know, I think for myself, had I lived a little while ago, because I know my grandmothers had these, chances are I wouldn't be sitting here. I would be busy washing clothes. You know how much time that took? Washing machines is the greatest invention ever. No, but really, you know, in the winter, we have no idea. We have no idea. So when we come home, for many of us, there may be quite a few things to attend to. Things accumulated, things to deal with. There are challenges in life. And there may be areas of our life that kind of hasn't quite fallen into place. Doesn't go so easy for us. And it's true, we need to find skillful ways of moving into life and caring for our life. But I think it's good to have perspective that we're the kind of people that are fortunate enough to be able to sit in a circle and bring the hands together in a gesture of focusing on the heart, bowing to each other, sensing into the nature of things, sensing into the core of existence. Now that's really something. We don't have to take down those washboards and spend days doing washing or plowing the fields just to live. You know, at the time of the Buddha actually, and this has been the case of spiritual practitioners for most of human existence. We can be romantic about going off into the cave or leaving it all. You know, the Buddha actually left his baby boy and his wife. He left them and took off. Now, what would we think of a man doing that today? Right? And so, sometimes, we don't know exactly, because it's a long time ago, and there are many stories, and myths are being created, and of course, it's made heroic, right? And we can be grateful, because the Buddha spent more than 40 years walking across India with many, many followers and practitioners, and that they could do that, and this body of teaching was created and then preserved from one generation to the next, is wonderful. But there were also people in the villages working, caring for the land, caring for the food. Our situation is extraordinary. In our time, there are still monks and nuns caring, in a way, the heart practice of Buddha Dharma. But we're fortunate because we have so many choices. We can choose, in a way, how we like to live. We can experiment how our being and our life can be of good use and be expressed. It's a wonderful thing. Rumi says, "Let the beauty you love be what you do. There are a thousand ways to kneel and kiss the ground." So the practice we do here, it's simple. We try to have as little ritual as we can to just keep it clear and human, so that we all can connect and we can claim it and make it our own. Our insights and our understanding, precious as they are, it's the first step on the Eightfold Path, the path that makes us into noble beings, noble-hearted beings, is to understand, to see clearly. But then we have to make those understandings and insights our own. They become our own, ours to claim, when we live them. Only then. We have to live them. then we can claim them as ours. That's how the heart is transformed, and probably how our brain is rewired as well. So in this time of transition, in moving outwards in all directions as we will, across the land, a little bit across the air, and we come home, it's really important to care for this time of transition so it's not too abrupt, so we don't fall back too fast into the pushy nature of things. Most of us are just, we're just too busy, and it's actually not good for us and our being. And we live in a culture that worships being busy and the ability to multitask. I'm not so sure multitasking is a good skill, really, if it's a good skill for us. So go slow with yourself, you know. Coming home, tonight is not the best night to pay bills. I mean, sometimes we just have to do what we have to do, and then we have to deal with what we have to do as calmly as possible. But often we have a choice. If the choice is given, tonight is not the night to pay all the bills, empty all the cupboards and closets and make the total makeover into some kind of zen-like existence, clean it all out. It's not the night to come to your partner and tell him or her a thing or two that you've understood about them. You know, they haven't been on retreat and maybe they're not so interested. Really? Maybe not. Maybe they just like to be with you. It's not the time to have a good look at the relationship and make grand new plans. It's actually not the time to make grand new plans for now. I'm going to, and whatever. Go to the cave, practice 5 hours a day. It's not the time. Transition. If you've been to outer space, if you're an astronaut, people will kind of assume that you would like a few days just to sort of chill. If you've been an explorer in the most remote regions of Amazonian jungle, one could guess that you would just like to hang around a bit. Let's say you've been to some kind of strange clinic where there's been internal rewiring going on, and quite subtle, kind of, maybe at times almost like surgery, like heart surgery. One would think, okay, it's a good thing to be convalescent, you know, to let it all integrate. Metabolization of practice is really important. So let it go slow. Have space around things. Let yourself have space around things. You may have 1, 2, 3. If you're fortunate, you can have more space and time. This is a lovely poem by Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous, complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down into the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is your plan to do with your one and precious life. And so this question, what to do with this one and precious life, the second part, the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, is the practice of intention. The practice of intention is the inclining of the heart and mind to that which we know to be true, to be right for us, to be good, to be of goodness, to be supportive for us and others, to orient towards that, to remember that, and to give that support. It is not goal orientation to set up goals or make mission statements. We can do these things. It's not a bad thing to set up goals. But the practice of intention is something that happens now. It's not, although it has implications for the future and the next moment, it's something that is real now and will reverberate like rings on the water when we go in and swim into the still lake. It will have a ripple effect within our being. The Buddha said that the number one factor that impacts the mind the most, the factor that has the most weight in the mind, is intention. The way we look at things. So the way, if we turn towards kindness and care, then this is what the experience will be in the mind, in the heart. And so it's a simple practice when we really engage and know that our intention matters. Our intention in the little things, to pay attention and to orient. Sometimes we don't know what to do. We don't know what choice to make. We get stuck and in a corner. That's natural. And we feel a bit disheartened and disconnected. At the end of the retreat, it can be a little bit like a blues, like it was great, and then we feel a bit disconnected. It's like there's a real nourishing feeling in sitting in this circle, right? And it can be great to go home and joyful, and sometimes it can feel a bit lonely. And then to remember to orient the mind to care and the heart to support that. So we don't need to find the answer, what will I do with my one precious life? We don't need to look for the answer, think really hard, read all the books, although reading books can be a really good thing. We don't need to make all that effort to figure it all out so we have the best mission statement ever and we know what we're doing and we're going to do it. We don't need to aim for perfection in that way. It's more important to allow that question to be asked sincerely, what am I going to do with my life? And then see how you can become the answer to that, how life turns into the answer. We can't really say always what we're supposed to do. Can't really know. We can't always have a clear strategy and control. Life is not controllable. But we can orient ourselves towards that which we know to be true and to be good and to be of support. If anything, a retreat can teach us how to value the simple pleasures in life, right? The very simple pleasures. We don't need so much, and to enjoy is important. Each summer I have a little ritual of sorts with my children. We go down to the beach nearby and we sit there, and I usually, it's kind of when school has ended, so I ask them, what do you want to do this summer? What would be nice for you? You can wish for anything. I'm not sure it will happen, but go on wishing and let's see where we go with it. And I'm always kind of curious what will come out. And this year, well, actually first, they were not so interested in the question because they had an idea, and they said to me, you know, when you die, that'd be kind of cool because we get all your money. I thought to them, okay, you might be disappointed, kids, but okay. And then they thought, so, and then when you die, we thought actually we could bury you here on the beach because we like to be here. It's a nice beach. It's easy to dig in the sand, not much work. And you like to be near the water. And my daughter said, I can pick flowers, put it on the grave. And I was thinking, hey, we're planning summer. We're not planning my burial. But of course, it also did light in my heart. It's like, yeah, we can do it. Why not? You never know, right? So then we went on to the summer plans, in case we would all be around. And so if you can wish for anything, but what I hear my children say is they kind of want to do what they know to be good. Simple, nice things. Go swimming. Yes, maybe have an extra large ice cream with 5 scoops now and then. But not so many extraordinary things. They're content with little because that's what does us good. When we value presence and when we have space. We need to have a simple life in a very practical sense in order to have space around things. And there we actually have choices. We can't do all and have all. The equation doesn't come together. At some point, one has to make some kind of choices. And that's why renunciation is so much at the foreground of this practice, not as a kind of new identity. For the longest time in my practice, I tried to live like a kind of nun. It didn't fit me at all. I like beautiful things. I like to do stuff. I like experiences. I like to be in life. But the understanding of renunciation as a true expression doesn't come from that outer trimmings, you know, in the way where you have a certain attitude or way of carrying yourself. Some of that is good too, but really as an understanding that it opens life. When we simplify, it opens life. And you know, speaking of my children, I have never taught them meditation. I do not give Dharma talks to my neighbors when we meet at the mailbox. It's not really what's needed. And so it can be fine to share, but truly, it's the embodiment in life, how we carry ourselves. That is the true teaching. That is what we transmit. Some of you asked for one of the poems that were read one evening. I'll read it again now. It was in one of the last sittings. And I'll put it on the notice board afterwards. It's from Hafiz, Sufi poet, long since dead, who was called, his nickname was the Tongue of the Invisible. And this one is a little bit adapted to this retreat. It's a little bit altered. It's called Cast All Your Votes for Dancing. And with the Sufi poets, they kind of always speak to themselves. Their songs and their poetry is a kind of dialogue with Hafiz to Hafiz and to the nature of things. It's a kind of self-guidance, one could say. I know the voice of depression still calls you. I know those habits that can ruin your life still sends their invitations. But you are paying attention now and look so much stronger. You can stay that way and even bloom. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from your practice and from your companion's beautiful laughter. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from the insignificant movements of your own holy body. Learn to recognize counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment's pleasure, but then drag you on for days like a broken person behind a farting camel. You are here now. Learn what actions of yours bring freedom and love. Whenever you speak what is true, dear pilgrim, my ears wish my head was missing so they could finally kiss each other and applaud all your nourishing wisdom. Oh, keep squeezing drops of the sun from your practice and your work and play, and from your companion's beautiful laughter, and from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Now, sweet one, be wise. Cast all your votes for the heart's dancing, the heart's awakening. So trust in this, the three refuges in this path of awakening, to trust in the possibility of awakening in Buddha nature, in the absolute awake goodness, that is the human potential, the human birthright. To take refuge in the Buddha is not to take refuge in a historical person or the memories and stories of somebody long since dead. It is that potential in the heart. And to take refuge in the Dhamma, in the truth of life, the book of life, the truth of one's own body and experience, that is the practice field, that of relationship and all of life, of knowledge, to study, to learn, but to study and learn through experience, not as a mere intellectual pursuit. To take refuge in the Dhamma, that there are those that have gone before us, that accumulated experience, and it's being shared from one generation to the next. Isn't that wonderful? And if you think what we have the whole World Wide Web. We have so much information, just one click away. Ask something and it goes, whoa. You want poetry by Hafiz? You know what to do. Turn towards that that really nourishes your being. Find that information. And go into it deeply. And thirdly, the most important refuge is the Sangha, the friends on the path, the brothers and the sisters of the path, this living generation of practitioners. To appreciate that. It's really without the Sangha, it's one of the three jewels necessary for awakening, to treasure that. You know, when the Buddha died, after all these years of teaching and walking around everywhere and relating to the practitioners and followers, and Ananda, who happened to be Buddha's cousin and also the person that was close to the Buddha and supported him in practical matters. So when the Buddha died, what did Ananda say? It is told in the stories that Ananda kind of broke down in immense tears, and he didn't lament, oh, he was so great or so radiant or so powerful or so super great. He lamented, oh, he was so kind. He was so kind. Let's keep it simple and practice well. So I'm delighted to have spent this time with you. It's been joyful. And so if our paths cross again, I'll be delighted. And may you be well on your onward journeys.
So ending the retreat and continuing our lives. It's useful, I think, at this point to just reflect a little on what has been important for us here. Because what has been important for us here is probably what will continue to be important for us in our lives. The experiences that we have on a retreat can be beautiful, can be challenging, can be powerful. But in the end, being experiences, they arise in the conditions of the retreat. And when the retreat dissolves, many of the experiences too will, over time, begin to change. And so, one of the things we learn about experiences is that it's not so possible to keep hold of them. And we can't take the retreat with us. We might think, well, it would be really great, you know, if all these people would come home with me and if you could stay in the cupboard and every morning get out and we could sit together in a circle for 30 minutes. That would be really wonderful for me, but probably it would cause some trouble for everybody else. And they'd have to talk to their families and, you know, negotiate with other people. So that's not so possible. We can't necessarily take this form with us. But what is it that's made this form what it is? Some of the foundations of what is here we can take into our lives. To take that intention we all established at the beginning to so far as we can refrain from causing harm to others. To have a sense of holding the well-being of all of life in our heart as a lens against which we look at our choices and our actions. And allow it to inform them. Which doesn't mean we don't take care of ourselves too, because we are one of those beings we need to care for. And it doesn't mean that we're somehow perfect at having no impact in the world, but that we're sensitive to it. Just as we've learned to be sensitive here. And that sensitivity, although that too will change, there's a very kind of amplified kind of sensitivity here that's part of what allows the practice to go deep as it does. And that it's right to let that sort of soften a bit, gently as it will, over time, respecting it. But over time, we might notice we start to sort of experience ourselves a little bit more in familiar ways of our life. And that's okay. But being interested to see what's possible for me here in this situation. So learning to let go. This lesson we get many, many opportunities to practice. Allowing ourselves to let go of the retreat and yet keeping close with what we've received in the learning and the understanding. That sense, and what Leela was just speaking about, of Sangha, that we can't do this path by ourselves. Nobody else can do it for us. But it's so important that we make a priority of seeking out and spending time with others who likewise share and value the things that we value. And that doesn't mean they have to look like people who do cross-legged meditation, watching their breath for 45 minutes at a time and then walking slowly back and forth. They might be. There's some great people who do that in the world. But there's also some really wonderful and remarkable people who don't have anything to do with that sort of thing. But who, if you're there in a way that's authentic in your life and you're willing to speak of what concerns you and about and share about what you love, you'll find other people for whom that too is important. And for me, it seems one of the most crucial things for our own life and for this world, that we allow ourselves to speak of and to share in a quiet way, in a sensitive way, but yet also in a courageous way, what it is that we feel that's important. And I don't mean going and knocking on people's doors and telling them, you know, can I interest you in meditation? Not that sort of thing, but more when you're talking and you feel someone might be interested or open. And they seem interested, yes, to share, to take a risk sometimes. Because it's really easy to feel that the world is populated by all these people who don't seem to care, who are only worried about themselves or concerned about their own and busy getting as much as they can for themselves and to heck with everybody else. It can look like that sometimes, but actually the truth of it is that that's not most people's inner experience. Most people are looking and trying the best they can to take care of what they care about. And to find ways to meet each other at that level and ways that we can really respectfully be in this world requires us to be a little bit vulnerable, a little bit courageous in a sense, and being able to say what we feel and what we really think and what we really honour in our hearts. And when we do this, and in many ways we've done this by coming here, we've expressed something that we recognize as important or something we wanted to explore, what we find, and this is an expression of this truth, that there are other people who want to do the same. And by coming together with other people, we support each other and ourselves. I heard of some research done in America recently. It was actually because of the concerns and actually much of the Western world and beyond now around healthy diets and the impact of unskillful eating on general health and well-being in our human species, really. And the survey was basically concerned with, I think, children between about 5 or 6 and 11 or 12 years old. I don't remember exactly. But they measured, with quite a large population, how many messages. They worked out how much time they spend watching television, on the computer, going to movies, exposed basically to commercial advertising and sort of media input, how many messages they would receive about unhealthy eating habits. And they worked out that the average child watching the average amount of this and doing the average amount of this would get on average about 10,000 messages a year of really unhealthy eating habits that were saying this is how you should do it, that would be really unhealthy for them. And then they worked out, this was the easy piece, if the parents of those children or whoever's looking after them should give them a message every mealtime, every day of healthy eating, that's about 1,000 messages a year. And you immediately start to see the problem, what you're up against. If the children are getting 10,000 messages not healthy, 1,000 messages from their parents, who they don't listen to anyway, of course, at least at a certain point, we see how we can be surrounded by messages that are not actually supporting what's wholesome. And that's just at the level of diet, food. There's so many other messages we're getting. And to be aware that that is the environment that we might be placing our hearts and our minds in unknowingly. Because what we see in practice is that our hearts and our minds, they're not something separate from what is around us. They are affected and affect everything. And so being aware of what we place ourselves in contact with, being aware of the importance of recognizing what truly nourishes us, and making sure, making it a priority that we place ourselves in those circumstances. So times when we're quiet, you know, making a commitment, if we can, on a regular basis, to take some time to sit or to walk, or to stand, but to be still, to not be active, to not be productive, to not be ticking things off the list of things to do, but just doing nothing, because we understand there's something important about that. And with that, it doesn't really matter so much how long we do the formal practice for. There's something really powerful about the intention to do it regularly. And maybe we can't every day. Maybe it's 5 times or 6 times a week we can manage it. Maybe if you have small children at home, it's hard to even do that. But see what's possible. And make an intention. Make it specific. Say, yes, for the next month, I want to do this 20 minutes in the morning. I can do it. May mean giving up a little bit of time cozy under the duvet, sort of when we've woken up but we're not really sure if we want to get up. It's kind of nice that, isn't it? But it doesn't actually take our life forward. And at the same time, not getting too tight around the numbers. I think I said in one or two of the groups that, you know, we kind of made the schedule up, Leela and I. We do it every time. And other people make it up differently. There's no magic in the numbers. But there's something about committing ourselves and expressing that commitment. And, you know, the idea is often expressed, and just as a, I find this a very useful thing to reflect on, about, you know, how much should I meditate? And Ajahn Chah was once asked by a student, you know, how much should I meditate? How long should I meditate? I'm really busy. I've got my work, I've got my family, I've got all my social activities and my charitable undertakings. How long should I practice? And Ajahn Chah said to him, you know, if you have time to meditate, you should sit for 30 minutes every day. And if you have no time to meditate, you should sit for 1 hour every day. What's it saying about our life if we say, I have no time for what's important? So it might be that we can get together with other people to do this. And I know Naroda has sort of, there's the sitting group in Helsinki, and maybe you're in Helsinki and can get to that, and that's great. And maybe you live somewhere else in some more distant location and there aren't lots of people there, but maybe if you ask around or just mention that you're going to, you might find others who might share. Or you might make a phone date where you're not going to sit in the same room, but you're just going to say, yeah, let's do it now with someone you know, and then go and do your meditation. You can even get an app, the Insight Timer app. I don't know if you've checked it out, but you know, you can, if you want, you can plug into a worldwide community of thousands of people who meditate. And it tells you about all the people who are practicing while you are. And also tells them, if you want, that you're meditating right now. You don't have to let them know. You can turn that bit off, I believe. But just something about connecting with others, it's really essential. It's really important. And in that, that sense of our inner commitment, but also our shared commitment, the coming together of what we call the inner and the outer. So in our life, we also find ways to take care of this world. And this world that so deeply needs our care and our love and our action at times in support of what can be done. So that inner practices of meditation and of kind of the cultivation of the wholesome, of reflecting on the truth of change and seeing what that means for my life, that things will not always be as they are. Looking at the way in which we see so much of life as just unfolding, that we don't make it happen, we're not in control of it. And what does that mean for how do I live my life? Not just how do I do my meditation. And those kind of reflections of, oh yeah, we're touched by each other. And so many of you spoke of being touched by each other. How can I continue to touch this world? Kindness is definitely a central expression of what's important. And the other expression that for me seems equally central is the capacity to stand up at times and say no when something's not okay. To not just sort of think, well, I've got to be nice to people, so if I say no and they don't like when I challenge something or when I question something, then that's not very kind. Actually, it's a real kindness to have the courage to say, when we see something isn't healthy, when something isn't wholesome, to say, actually, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to give support to that. It doesn't mean we have to sort of get a placard and have a banner and walk around the town saying, you know, don't do this, don't do that. But we might want to do that sometimes. We might want to engage with or support groups and people who have chosen to take a very active expression of response in the world. Just as we see when inner tendencies of reactivity, of cruelty, or of sort of disinterest for our experience, when these arise in ourselves, they don't serve us. And we need to be active and engaged to bring forth some kindness in the face of maybe more sort of a cruelty or a negativity. Or we need to bring forth some interest when we feel like, oh, I can't really be bothered. Likewise in the world, an active response to things, to the condition of human beings, to the condition of animals, to the condition of our planet. It requires us to make a response. In order to be able to make a response, we need to be nourished. We need to not be just surviving. And so spending time in the natural environment or engaging in what it is that you love, whether it be being outdoors, which is something I love, or whether it be going to art galleries, which is not something that I love, but what it is for you. What it is for you. These things are so important. You know, they say that nobody ever lay on their deathbed wishing they'd spent more time in the office. And I would add to that, unless, of course, what you do in your office is what you love and what you value. And if that's how it is for you, then also that's remarkably fortunate. And not impossible at all. Not impossible at all. So, the short version of this closing talk, that in some circumstances where there's less time I say it a little differently, and it's simply this. I could say it maps as a summary. It's good what you've been doing here. Keep doing it. There's something wholesome, something beautiful that's being expressed in us and through us. And we know that. There's something in us knows that, something in us that can recognize that. Keep listening and allow yourself to be guided and informed, and give yourself permission for getting it wrong, as we will, and knowing we can always begin again. Just as with the breathing we might lose it, we can come back. So too in our practice it might at times be a bit more challenging, but we can always come back to it. And likewise in our lives, it's a journey in which we are learning. And we haven't yet grown up. We haven't. Our bodies might have done that. But we're still in the process. We're still in the growing. And sometimes there's growing pains associated with that. But to just recognize that that's okay in the journey. That's okay in the process. And that our hearts have a resilience and a capacity to rise again in life in the face of even the most, at times, incredible challenges we may face and that others face in this world. I'm often inspired by and moved to just contemplate and reflect on the natural world as a great teacher. And one of the things that I like to do is to just make a point of noticing when there's a little flower growing in a concrete wall, out of a little niche with a little dust that maybe a little something fell into that turned into enough basis for a flower to grow out. And you wonder, how did that little expression of life manage to do that on the side of a concrete wall? If you just don't take it for granted, it's easy just notice ugly concrete wall. But if you look closely, oh, there's something growing on that. How does it do that? How does it do that? Or you know, with those roads that we build so we can go more quickly, more places, and move more things so we can have more things and all of that, and go to more places where there are different things which we can bring back and keep with the other things, you know. What I find fascinating with roads is if you look at them, or footpaths even, around the edges, if you leave them alone, little blades of grass start pushing their way up through. Little green, soft, mushy stuff gets in between that hard, black stuff, and it just goes like this, and it goes, and left alone, those roads get broken up. If you've ever seen a road that's it's been changed so the road goes somewhere else, within a few years, it's starting to disintegrate. It's like the power of life, of soft, tender, green movement of vitality to break into, to move into and to open up even the places that seem most dense, most hard, most far from life. They're not so far at all. And whether we're talking about the surfaces of the world or the conditions of our heart, it's not so far at all. And often it's just a simple turning that takes place within. A simple returning to where we are. A reorienting towards what is important and what we love. And from that, life flows. From that, life moves. And to trust that in yourselves, in each other, and in this world. And so, I too would like to express my appreciation for you all here, for being here, for your practice, for the courage and the commitment that I know it takes to do this. And for the honesty and the vulnerability and the beauty with which you've shared your journeys with us and with each other. And I too would like to wish you well in your journey. And if we may meet also, that would be lovely. I'd like to also say thank you on behalf of both Leela and myself, and also the managers, for the kindness and generosity you've expressed to us in many ways, for the support you've offered in the giving of dana and the sharing in that way too. Thank you. It's deeply appreciated. So, I think that's all I wish to say at this time. We'd like to finish with a short loving-kindness meditation together. So,
be comfortable. It will just be a minute or two. Let body, mind, and heart relax. Soften where it's possible to soften. And breathe this living breath. Sensing your heart, your own good heart, the fullness of the heart, not just the heart that's gone through all the experiences in life, but also the heart that has remained untouched. The heart of truth, the essence of heart. Absolute beauty and kindness and peace of heart. And that is here now, regardless of what I've been or what may come. Allowing the practice of metta to orient towards the good. Let it be relaxed. It's like following a stream downwards. Wishing together. May the fruit of our practice here on this retreat, may all our efforts and our sincerity, our willingness to engage and be intimate with, our willingness to look carefully, may all the fruits of our practice be for the good of all beings. Feeling in the heart, this existence of ours, allowing this field of awareness that is also the field of metta, of kindness, of loving kindness, to expand effortlessly from the depth of your heart, including one and all in this circle, including Tapio a little bit further away, the managers in the kitchen, the other people here around. In fact, all the people stretching out across the land, Finland, beyond, all across the earth, all these human beings, young and old, big and small, awake, asleep, all beings. The field of metta, including all the creatures in the sea of enormous proportions, of all shapes and sizes and form. The creatures in the rivers and the waters and the little droplets, tiny ones, invisible ones. The creatures on the land, the four-legged ones, big and small, young and old. The winged creatures and the creatures in the air. The creatures in the earth, the earth dwellers. All these waves of green that come through the earth. The growing things. The flowers and the leaves and the grasses and the trees. May all beings be safe and live in peace. May all beings be safe and live in peace. May all beings be safe and live in peace. in the field of metta, including our loved ones, the people we know, people we love, with this wondrous capacity in the heart, sensing all our relations, stretching back in time, all the people before us and those that will come after us. May all beings in all the realms and universes, may all beings be safe and peaceful. May all beings be safe and peaceful. May all beings be safe and peaceful. May all beings everywhere awaken. May all beings awaken. May all beings awaken. May all beings awaken.